into your presence. We acknowledge you are your sovereignty of our lives. We thank you for this privilege to be your church here in Sydney, gathered for a Bible study from one of your experienced evangelists, Mr. Raymond McNair. We do ask that your Holy Spirit guide and lead and direct everything that's said and done here tonight. We ask for your inspiration upon this study. Help us to comprehend the message. Help us to draw closer together as your people in the worldwide effort. We thank you for this privilege and pray these things for your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, it's my privilege to have the opportunity to introduce Mr. McNair. My experience with Mr. McNair goes back to 1969 when I came to Bricketwood as a freshman. And many people around Australia, many of the ministries in Australia, were at Bricketwood from 1960s to late the middle 70s. And Mr. McNair was the Deputy Chancellor at that time. And then he went to Pasadena, became Deputy Chancellor in Pasadena, and now serves as Regional Director in New Zealand. We all have very fond memories of Mr. McNair. He taught us a lot of subjects at Bricketwood. He always exemplified, as far as I'm concerned, a very humble Christian serving attitude, and was an inspiration to us to get to the core of what really matters in attitudes of service to your fellow men. So I have privilege today to introduce for the first time for about 23 years, I believe, Mr. McNair in the Sydney area, and he'll take the Bible study for the rest of the evening.
Mr. Dean, and I suppose I should put this microphone on before I go on. One of those you put around your neck, yes. Let's see, I'm going to fasten it to the other side. Oh, I see. Is that it? So, it's just, I leave it right there. Is that going to be okay in case I move over here to explain some things? We're ready to go. Well, greetings to all of you. And I bring greetings not only from my wife, we both greet you, but from the ministers and brethren in New Zealand and the South Pacific, Fiji, Tonga, and the other areas here. My wife and I have been serving here in the South Pacific, where I've been serving as regional director for the last 4 years. We will be, God willing, returning to the States in a few months' time. We don't know the exact time. We have mixed feelings. We're looking forward to that very much. But we'll always, as indeed I have many fond memories of the brethren and the college and the churches where I served for 15 years in Britain. I see formerly the person over here that I knew and her family when they were young and unmarried. They were married and not quite so young, most of us. But anyway, we certainly will have many fond memories of our work here in the South Pacific. This is at least my third trip to Australia. The last time I was here, I believe, was with Mr. Armstrong about 1969 or 70. And I was here once before, a few years before that. This is my third trip to Australia. Perhaps the longest time I've spent in Australia. We will be spending the Sabbath up on the Gold Coast, the church there, and meeting with some of the office and staff and ministers and so forth this coming Friday and Sabbath and Sunday. And then we will be returning to Auckland on Monday, God willing. We spent last Sabbath in Melbourne and had a very fine meeting there with the combined churches, all the combined churches in the Melbourne area. And certainly enjoyed meeting the ministers and brethren there. And we enjoyed very much meeting a number of you brethren. Of course, the ministers that we've got to meet here, and hopefully we'll have a little more time to visit with some of them, as well as some of you, after the Bible study. I will just say, before getting into the study, that Everything seems to be coming along very well in New Zealand. The income for the last 2 months has been up above the previous the previous month last year. So that's a very welcome sign when both in the States and I believe here, the last I heard the income had been a little lower than that. We had had a traumatic experience with the defection of one of the ministers I'm sure you heard about, and I was especially happy to be there, having known the minister and his family for many years, and having served with him. He served as a faculty member under me, this particular minister, years ago, and I'm especially happy that we were there at that time, though it was a somewhat traumatic period. But everything has settled down. The churches are doing well. Many have remarked more recently that the Auckland Church seems happier now, more united than in many years. I think things are coming together. Some of the problems hopefully have been resolved. There will always be problems in churches, in any church, because when you have people, you'll have problems. And people have problems whether converted or unconverted. The difference is when we were converted, we're members of God's church, and God helped us with those problems, and we look at them God's way, and we look to God for solutions instead of looking to the world and always traveling on the world's way. Anyway, I don't want to take too much time for preliminary introductions, otherwise I won't have time for the study. And I do have planned what I believe is should be a very interesting and profitable study. I think it's unlikely that you will ever hear a Bible study or maybe a sermon on this exact subject in your life. I have some material that I will go through tonight. Really, it would be take at least a half dozen or a dozen studies to cover it thoroughly, and we'll cover as much as I can to give you a background on some of this material. First of all, I might just start off by referring to some articles here, and here, first of all, from the Australian paper that, see if I can pick up the right one. The weekend, Australian, March the 7th, 8th, 1992. Here's an article regarding the Prime Minister, Mr. Keating, and how this controversy has flared up regarding the Union Jack and whether or not Australia should remain a member of the Commonwealth, but pay the same respect and allegiance to the mother country, or whether she should be a little more independent, perhaps remove the Union Jack, and so forth. Now, let me read just a few paragraphs from some of these articles, and then I'll get right into study. Says Mr. Keating, spoke Republican fires again by suggesting that it was a curiosity to have the Union Jack in the corner of the Australian flag. I'm sure that plenty of people in our neighborhood wonder about us, whether we are, as we describe ourselves, as being a nation, when there is so much ambiguity about our flag. Anyway, talks about the recent controversy over his touching of the Queen when guiding her through the crowd at Parliament House, Canberra. They said, "Are you sure you don't? You know the protocol? Make sure you put your arm around everyone." This is, I believe, the Prime Minister being quoted here, supposedly, the paper, and talks about the national sentiments here. Such sentiments had been uttered by writers and artists since the turn of the century and before, said Mr. Keating. Asked how could Australians be more Australian, he said, quote, "Well, for a start, by not tugging the forelock of the British establishment. That's the place for starters. The Liberal Party have yet to learn about that." I'm not putting any pressure on this debate. I'm just making a few simple points about Australia's independence from Europe, the fact that we're now a country trading our way in the Asia Pacific. And here were some New Zealand comments in the New Zealand papers. Actually, I don't want to take much time to read that, but very strong and quoting the British press. Showing how many people were fired up in Britain regarding the incidents that happened here, and I'm sure you're aware of that, and how the New Zealanders in the main seemed to feel the proper respect wasn't being shown to the Queen the royal family, and so forth. Now, an article, Bolger, that's Prime Minister Bolger of New Zealand, emphatic about UK links. The Prime Minister, Mr. Bolger, in the presence of the Duke of Edinburgh yesterday, went out of his way to stress New Zealand's strong links with Britain and the royal family. Speaking to war veterans, anyway, he went on to mention some things here. Said affections between New Zealand and Britain remain strong. He was speaking against the background of the emphasis placed by the Australian Prime Minister, Mr. Keating, on independence during the recent royal tour by the Queen and Prince Philip, and Mr. Keating's drive that Britain deserted Australia in the Second World War. Well, I don't want to get into that. Actually, Britain was virtually on her back and was struggling for her very existence, and I think she felt that she would defend herself, her own country, then she could eventually come to the rescue. Otherwise, if she sent her troops off, you know, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and all the other places, Canada, she wouldn't be able to defend the... I said her troops. I know you had troops, Australian troops there under the command of the British military at the time. Anyway, it goes on to say here, Prince Philip, in his speech to the gathering, indirectly referred to the Keating controversy. And he said that he didn't want to, quote, let such trivialities as politics come between them, that is, Australia and New Zealand. The Australian High Commissioner to New Zealand, Mr. Rob Laurie, had a difficult time at the function in Dublin to mend his country's fences with the royal family. So here it was mentioning how that the Prime Minister of New Zealand said they wanted to stress New Zealand's strong links with Britain and the royal family. This evening, I want to talk about the British royal family, and I want to talk about where that the throne of Britain really came from, where it goes back to, and what should our attitude in the Commonwealth, and I think even in America, though we're not under or in any way associated, even with the Commonwealth, I mean with the royal family, the Queen is not our sovereign. But still, many in America have great respect and regard for her and follow, every move of the royal family, even though years ago, in the days of George III, we rejected the British government, and you know that struggle resulted in American independence. Here's a recent article, last one, Time, March the 9th, 1992. This is the Australian edition of Time magazine. It's entitled, If His Left Hand Offends. Oh, those weapons in the former colony. During the visit to Australia of Queen Elizabeth, Prime Minister Paul Keating had the temerity just look at his hand to touch the royal persons. Well, actually, I will just say I think sometimes some of the protocol may be a little bit extreme. But anyway, that's not the main thing I'm talking on tonight. It says, which etiquette forbids. Not only that, his wife Anita had merely bowed upon meeting Her Majesty, declining to curtsy, which etiquette demands. In a speech with the monarch present, Keating hinted that his country might become a republic, which would end the Queen's role as head of state. Utter buffoon. And, well, I don't even want to mention this one, worst word. According to the British MPs, what can you expect from the leader of a country of ex-convicts? Well, don't feel too bad, you Aussies. America was a dumping ground, especially Georgia, the state of Georgia. That's where the Ku Klux Klan came from, I think, and some of that. But anyway, America was a dumping ground for some of the ex-cons before Australia. Then once we won our independence, Britain had to look around someplace else. And I think this was God actually directing this country to be settled, and he knew some of the stronger people, and perhaps some of the better people in the nation weren't necessarily always the, quote, blue blood, I know that sort of thing. People, you know, the upper crust, but some of the people that might have been even looked upon as petty thieves or, you know, poachers or what have you, that probably in some ways were... a little bit more would serve as a backbone of starting a new nation than some of the uppity people. But be that as it may, Keating fired back, scorning old fogies at home who catered to the crown and acidly claiming that Britain had deserted Australia during World War II when it was under heavy threat by the Japanese.
'twas a delicious Donnybrook enjoyed by one and all, end quote. Well, I'm not here to either praise or defend this, that, or the other person for what they did or didn't do, but I do want, since it has to do with the royal family this evening, I would like to let me see if I can put that microphone down a bit. I don't know. I guess just tilt it down this way. I would like to show you the origin of the British royal family. And again, I'll just quote this without turning to read these scriptures, because I've got so much more to give you that I know I won't have time to give half of it. I'll just refer to the scriptures in the book of Peter and otherwise, where God says, give respect to whom respect is due and honor to whom honor is due. And the Bible talks about people who despise dignitaries, who despise people in high office. That's mentioned over in the book of Jude and Peter. And the Bible does show to us that you and I as Christians should give honor unto whom honor is due and respect unto whom respect is due. And of course, there is such a thing as observing the proper etiquette and that sort of thing. I don't believe any human being should be above being touched or anything of that nature. I think sometimes human rules get a little bit out of hand. In fact, I had the privilege of seeing Queen Elizabeth II, knight or whatever you'd call it, Prince Charles, or invest him, I guess was the right word, on July 1st, 1969. I was there and wrote an article for our magazine, Tomorrow's World. How many of you remember the Tomorrow's World magazine? Some of you old-timers, oh my, but half or two-thirds of you do. Well, this was one of our magazines for many years, had some interesting articles. An article I wrote in 1969, after the investiture of Prince Charles, I was there and saw that, was an article here entitled The Astounding Truth Behind the World's Oldest Throne. The British throne is the oldest in the world. In July, half a billion people saw via worldwide television, Britain's heir apparent, her future king, that is assuming he lives to that time, invested with the symbols of that royal house. Will the British throne, like so many other thrones of Europe, soon become extinct? Here is the fascinating history and the thrilling future of the 3,000-year-old royal throne of Britain. Where did this throne come from? And where will it end up? I think that's a very interesting question. And this evening, I want to go into that a little bit. On this picture, you see the coronation chair with the stone of skull, in which many books that I have here, and you can read all over the place, that say that strong traditions say that the people who came into Ireland and then into Scotland carried this stone with them from the land of Israel, and that it is indeed the very stone on which Jacob laid his head. Now, that's not the main point of the study tonight, but it is an interesting point. And I have a book here that shows, according to the geographical or geological description of that stone, that kind of stone is found in numerous places throughout the land of Israel, the Promised Land. This book clearly shows that, the Stone of Destiny, and shows the official description of the stone. It's a calcareous sandstone, and it shows that kind of stone is found in numerous places in the Holy Land, so it certainly could have come from the Holy Land. Yesterday, my wife and I went down to this building. Let me see if I can recall the name of it. Queen Victoria, well, anyway, whatever it is down here, building. It's a shopping place, and we just wanted to walk around there. We didn't buy anything. But I would suggest you go in there sometime, and up on, I think it's the third floor, second or third floor, but anyway, they have replicas of all the crowns and the swords of state and the scepter and all these things, of the accoutrements that go along, the paraphernalia with the royal family. And I think it would be interesting to go there and see it, because some of them, I believe, are the actual items on loan. Others, it says, are replicas. Most of them are replicas. But here's a picture of the crown jewels, in this case one of the crowns, or several state crowns. Perhaps I'll come to that a little later. Here's a book, The Queen's Silver Jubilee. This was several years ago. She came to the throne in 1952, was coronated in 53, and here is a picture of the Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, then other members of the family, which I won't spend a lot of time going to, and some other pictures here, but I'm not here to primarily to exalt anybody, but to tell you about this throne and where it came from and where it's headed. In some of the books that I have here, here again we find a picture of the head of the scepter, which I'll refer to a little later. The scepter that's up here in this Victoria building, and it's a large diamond, probably the most expensive diamond. I don't suppose you'd get that for, I don't know whether it'd be hundreds of millions or what, but it's a very expensive diamond, the largest cut diamond, I believe, in the world today, a very flawless and beautiful diamond. So this is the head of this scepter. The scepter has a diamond almost the size of, well, the size of a small hen egg. Here are a number of crowns and other things here. It shows the Queen seated with a scepter, a ruler's staff, in her hand. I'll refer to that later when I go back to Genesis and other scriptures to show you where what God says about that. She has here on the royal crown. And then later on, I want to refer to the British coat of arms, because this coat of arms has some very significant, symbols in the coat of arms that tie in with the Bible, the ancient history of the people of Israel and the people of the British Isles, who indeed have descended from those, according to the history, many histories. And I won't primarily get into that aspect of it tonight. I may a little bit. So anyway, let's now look at some of the scriptures. And let's see, according to the Bible, where did the present royal house of Britain come from? Where did the scepter that's in the hand of Queen Elizabeth, I don't mean necessarily that particular scepter, but I mean the ruler's staff, it refers to a particular throne. Where does that go back to? To begin with, let's turn to Genesis chapter 49. And I want you to notice here, in the 49th chapter of Genesis, and go rather quickly with me because I have quite a bit of scriptures, a number of scriptures, plus some histories and some material from some old history books I'd like to read. The elderly patriarch Jacob is speaking, as it says in verse 1. Shortly before his death, he gathered his 12 sons around him, and of those 12 sons, he mentioned, he mentioned various things, and it's especially interesting what he said to Judah. Judah was not the eldest. In verse 8, it says, Judah, you are he whom your brethren shall praise. Your hand shall be in the neck of your enemy, and your father's children shall bow down to you. In other words, he was to be the regal tribe, and all the other tribes would come and bow down to the leader, the king, that would eventually be established in the nation or the kingdom of Judah, to the tribe of Judah. Verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp, that is the young, like a young vigorous lion, the offspring of a lion, the king of the beasts. It says, from the prey, my son, you are gone up. He, that is Judah, like a lion, stooped down. He counts as a lion and as an old lion, that is a big, means in this case, a strong, fully mature lion. Who shall dare rouse him up? Now notice verse 10. This is the critical part. It says here in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Now, the word scepter means a ruler's staff. It's the staff, a stick, or of authority. Let me hold this up. If this was made out of gold with diamonds or whatever on it, and I was a king, this could be my ruler's staff. And the ruler's staff that Queen Elizabeth holds, that I showed you earlier here, that's probably the most gorgeous, the most expensive in the world.
Here again it shows the diamond and all encrusted with all sorts of gems, all sorts of lesser diamonds and pearls and rubies and so forth. Here it shows the queen holding the scepter in her right hand, the crown on her head. And I'm going to show you tonight that the Queen of England is a direct descendant of the tribe of Judah, going back to the house of David. And I want to show you how in history that came about, and how this is the oldest throne in the world, about 3,000 years old. And so here in Genesis 49, verse 10, God says, the scepter, that is the kingly staff, the staff of authority, the ruler's staff, shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, or a ruler's staff, as the marginal reference says, from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. That is, until Christ comes. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. That is, all nations will gather at Jerusalem when Christ comes back, but his leaders will, not you know, billions of people there at one time. So, notice there are certain things. First of all, the scepter was going to be established in the hand of a Jew, in the hand of a descendant of Judah. It would be put not in everyone's hand, but in the one whom God would appoint and select to be the king, but from the tribe of Judah. And it, once God put the scepter in the king's hand, or in this royal family in Judah, it would not depart. That scepter would remain in the hand of a Jew until Jesus Christ would come, until Shiloh would come, and unto him the gathering of the people be. Isaiah 66, Jeremiah 3:17 shows that at that time Christ will rule from Jerusalem, Palestine. It says all nations will be gathered together before him. Matthew 25 again shows that from one new moon to another, one Sabbath to another, all nations will go up to worship before Christ in Jerusalem. He of course is a descendant of David. He is a descendant of the tribe of Judah. Now, so keep that in mind, and it says that he was like a lion. Now, it is rather interesting when you look into the Bible, and I will just ask you to turn back and read this sometime. I will not read it here tonight, but when you check in the Bible, you will find that in Numbers 2, the second chapter, when the Israelites marched in the wilderness, the first tribe to march out was the tribe of Judah. They were the vanguard. They were right out of the spear's point, marching into the promised land. If they met any enemies, Judah was to be the first one. And you'll find that there it says each tribe was to march after or under his father's banner, his father's flag or ensign, and they had symbols, just like you have a symbol in this debate whether you want to change it and get rid of the Union Jack. Well, in ancient Israel, different ones had symbols. Now, the symbol for Judah was a lion, and we just read it there. The symbol for Joseph, by the way, was not a lion, but in the same chapter of Genesis 49, you read about the blessings of Joseph. And just read a little bit here, because I'm going to tie Joseph in only just momentarily this evening with Judah when I show you the symbols on the British coat of arms, a royal coat of arms. But come down to Joseph just a moment. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough, like a tree, a limb that's just full of apples hanging from it. Even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall, the archers, that is the enemies, have sorely, notice, grieved him and shot at him and hated him. But his bow, Joseph's bow, abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. Notice that. His arms, his military might, were made, the arms of his hands, held in his hands, were made strong by the, notice, by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Some say the shepherd stone of Israel, or the stone, some think that even refers to the stone of Scone. I don't want to digress into that, whether it does or doesn't. That was a stone that they were, that Jacob anointed, and that the Israelites carried with them. But anyway, let me go on here. It says, even by the God of your father who shall help you, and by the Almighty who shall bless you. And it goes on down to mention that. Now, very quickly, turn over to Deuteronomy 33, speaking of Joseph. We'll just cover this ever so briefly. Talks about the blessings, all the material blessings. He was given a double portion, blessed more than the other sons of Israel, so far as physical blessing. And verse 17, Deuteronomy 33, 17 says, his glory, that is Joseph's glory, is like the firstling of his bullock. We all know what a bullock is, like a bull out here in the field. His horns are like the horns of a unicorn, or of unicorns, and that word unicorn, if you'll look it up in the margin, it says, it means an ox or a wild ox. There is no creature with just one horn, unless one of the horns is broken off. With them, with his horns, Joseph, it says, will push the people together to the ends of the earth. And there are the tens of thousands of Ephraim, and there are the thousands of Manasseh. Now, one other scripture I'll refer you to, the latter part of Genesis 48, and it says that Joseph blessed, that is, rather, Jacob blessed, the sons of Joseph, Ephraim, Manasseh, and he says, Manasseh would become a great nation, and Ephraim would become a company of nations, or a commonwealth of nations. And if you want to know why Britain and the commonwealth have become great, it's not because of British cunningness or planning. In fact, Lord Seeley, who wrote A History of Britain, says, Britain established the empire in a fit of absence of mind. Britain went out here, colonists, you know, well, they started bringing prisoners down here. That's, I think we know, and this is not to put you down. They sent some over to America. That's why we're so great, too, if you want to know. But Britain didn't plan this. She didn't plan to someday rule over a quarter of the Earth's surface, over a quarter, or approximately a quarter of the peoples of the Earth, that the people of Joseph would take over the whole North American continent, the best farmland in the world, if you think of the vast tracts of land, the Mississippi, Missouri, and other Ohio River valleys, as well as up in Canada, the vast green-growing areas with a moderate climate, unlike much of Russia, which was a lot larger, but doesn't have a good climate and is nowhere near as good a land for growing crops and so forth as America. And as Canada, the United States. And then here, a large, very rich continent here, Australia. God gave two continents to the sons of Joseph. What do you think of that? Two out of the North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia. What is that, six continents? Well, anyway, North America, except for the little southern tip of Mexico. Now, Joseph has been given these great blessings more than any of the other people of Israel, and I don't want to go much more in this tonight except to tell you that that God says Joseph would not only receive all these blessings, and in First Chronicles, is it, or Second Chronicles here, where it says, let me find it here, anyway, where it says, but the First Chronicles, I believe it is, 5 verses 2, let's just turn to it quickly since I'm referring to it. The sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was the firstborn, forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed. His birthright, that is Reuben's birthright, it was his, but he lost it. His birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, that is Ephraim and Manasseh. The son of Israel, it says in verse 2, Judah prevailed above his brethren. Judah had the chief position because of Judah would come the Messiah. Of Judah would come the royal king that would rule Israel. That is, by God's direction. Of Judah, and for Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler, that is the chief ruler, the king. But the birthright was Joseph's. And over in Genesis 48, the last verses, it says he would receive a double portion. The other tribes received their blessings, but Joseph had the great blessings. And you remember I read in Deuteronomy 33 and in Genesis 49 where it says God would strengthen the arms of Joseph and make his bow, his military, you know, his weapons of war, mighty. And it says his arms would be strengthened by the arms of the God of Jacob. And it says, using the symbolism of him being like an ox, that he would push the nations to the ends of the earth. Now, I put it to you tonight, and this is not primarily what I'm speaking on, not on Joseph, that there is no nation or common or group of nations other than the United States and Britain and their commonwealth that have ever fulfilled that role in the history of the world. And I have written a couple of history books, one of them 700 and some pages, Bicentennial American History, How God Raised Up Our Nation. Don't ask for it. We ran out of print shortly after I published it. We only had 5,000 copies. It's so popular. No, I've had people ask about copies, and so that'll save you. I hope to reprint it someday. And I would dearly love, even more so, to write a history of the British Empire. I hope to do that, and when I get about 95 and can no longer carry on the ministry. I've done a lot of study in that, and the British Empire, the history of that is far more interesting than America and goes back far, far greater. Now, my ancestors also came from Scotland and from one of them from the apparently the royal family years ago, the McNaughtons, according to the clan book. But also on my mother's side, the Whittiers, we go back to the Normans, all the way back to several British kings, all the way back to William the Conqueror and on to Charlemagne on the continent. And I'm not here to preach Raymond McNair, but anyway, probably many of you have royal blood in your veins if you knew it. But anyway, don't get puffed up. You still have to eat and sleep and, you know, go to the bathroom and all the other things like everybody else, you know. That doesn't make you some super person. Anyway, so now then, as an example, in World War II and in World War I, who was it that defeated the Central Powers, World War I, and then the Axis Powers, Germany, Japan, and Italy, primarily in World War II? Whose armies fought in Africa and in Europe and in Asia and the Pacific? Whose armies and whose materiel was it sent to keep Russia, who was about to be knocked out of the war, and we sent many thousands of planes and guns and all sorts of things to keep Russia from being knocked on her back by Hitler? And most people don't realize that. It was Joseph, the sons of Joseph, and it was our armies, and it was our generals, it was our military, our navies that ruled the waves. And ever since the British, actually God sent a wind and defeated the Spanish Armada more than Drake and Hawkins and the British seamanship, and they did have some excellent seamen. But anyway, in 1588, when the very terrifying Armada, Spanish Armada, came against Britain, and Spain was ruling the sea, she ruled the seas, and she was raping the countries of Central America and South America, and all of their gold and silver and jewels and shipload and galleon after galleon going back to her country to enrich her. Drake, who my father always said on his mother's side was a descendant of Sir Francis Drake, I don't know whether that's so or not, but be that as it may, he and Hawkins and others went out. They thought they could relieve the Spaniards of some of their treasure. And anyway, in 1588, Britain defeated the Armada, and the British struck a medal saying, "He," meaning God, "blew," and they were scattered. Queen Elizabeth had that struck, Queen Elizabeth the First, by the way, in 1588, and the Dutch had a similar medal struck, showing that they believed, as Churchill says in Volume 1, he says the British have always believed that God gave them the victory there, as indeed he did at Dunkirk, and as indeed he did at El Alamein in North Africa, and as indeed he did at the Battle of Britain when the Germans thought they would knock the RAF out of the skies in a few short days, and they proved that, you know, they couldn't. Reuben, France, I don't want to go into that, but Mr. Partin, I think, has shown quite a bit to show that many of them are from Reuben, who came from the
Salt Sea, as some of their ancient records apparently say. But be that as it may, the French capitulated very quickly. They didn't have the stability, the strength of Joseph. And they rang Churchill and they said, well, you better surrender. And said, well, the Germans would just wring the neck of the British. And Churchill said, no way, nothing doing. He said, some neck, some chicken. And God did strengthen our arm. And God did give us the radar and later the first development of the A-bomb that certainly, if we'd wanted it, we could have, you know, Joseph could have conquered Russia and had her on her back in a short time and all the rest of the world. But we weren't out to conquer the world. We were just out to put the aggressors down. God strengthened our arms and our military might. Now, Joseph was to have the symbol, and in the wilderness they used, according to the Jewish encyclopedia and Jewish authorities, their symbol was an ox. And so when the rebellion occurred in about 930, when the 10 tribes revolted from the throne of David, what do you think? Jeroboam, who was an Ephraimite, who was a descendant of Joseph, an Ephraimite, what do you think he did? First thing he did, he set up a golden calf in, of all places, he set up a golden calf in Dan, in the, up in the northern part of the 10 tribes, and another one down in Bethel, between, just shortly inside the border, they set up these golden calves. And I've got a book, I didn't bring it tonight, I brought too many as it is, but anyway, and it says that the British people, the ancient Cymric peoples, worshiped the, quote, brazen bull. Still, when they came into Britain, the ancient Welsh, who to this day call themselves the Cymry, C-Y-M-R-Y, or Cymru, their national party, Plaid Cymru, and they came in as the ancient Cimmerians, or Cymry people, from around the Black Sea, as I hope to give you just a few references this evening. They came from the very area, these people, who came into Britain from the very area that God says the Israelites were taken when they went into captivity, and I hope to show you that a little later on the map. Now, who is it today who uses a national symbol by which they refer to their people? Is John Bull. You ever hear of John Bull? Does it refer to Japan or Germany or Britain? Well, I don't want to take any more time, but there is a reason why, and God had prophesied that the throne of David would be established later on, not in the land of Judah, but outside in the, among the tribes of Israel. And here today in Britain, you have the lion with a crown on its head that represents Judah there. The lion was their symbol, and the crown on the head of the lion showing that the kings came from the line of Judah. But on the British royal coat of arms, you'll notice you also have here an ox on the right side. It looks like a horse. It isn't. It has cloven hooks, both front and back hooks. It has a little swatter on the end of its tail like a cow, not a bushy tail like a horse. It is clearly an ox, and it's called a unicorn, but, you know, as I said, properly should be an ox. And you'll find on here about 9 different lions. Mainly this has to do with Judah, and it says, Oniswaki Malipons, the old Norman French, and it means woe or evil unto him who thinks evil. And down at the bottom, across the British royal coat of arms, it has Dieu et ma droit, God and my right. The right to rule that was given to Judah, the right, the birthright, remember 1 Chronicles 5 verse 2, but the birthright, the right that came by his birth that God gave, the birthright blessings went to Joseph, and Genesis 48 says it was a double blessing he was given. All the tribes had a blessing, but Joseph had a special one. That's the meaning. Now, so let's look and see a little bit further how this happened. We read, God says, he says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Now, if you will turn over, in fact, I don't think I will really take that much time to read this, but you can turn over to 1 Samuel,
16:13.
I want to give you some of the history tonight. You can get the biblical part portion later by your ministers here. If they don't know, they can look it up in a concordance. Right, Mr. Dean? Anyway, it says there that God sent his prophet Samuel to anoint a man by the name of David, and you can chase it back in many places, and David's line goes right back to the line of Judah. And that David anointed him to be king, and later on it says that all Israel anointed David to be king again, and he was again anointed there after Saul's death, and he became the first one to fulfill this prophecy: the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Now, by the way, another scripture, if you want to just write this down, I won't turn to read it. Numbers 24, verse 17. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. A scepter is a ruler's staff, and this was in the days when the Israelites were in the wilderness. The scepter had not yet been put in the hands of a Jew. It was only to be put in the hands of a Jew. He's called the root and the offspring of David, Revelation 22, verse 16. And also he's called there a bright and morning star. We read of rock stars, music stars, Hollywood stars, actresses. Stars are just illustrious people. And the star of all stars is the Messiah. And you'll find, as we'll see later in Luke chapter 1, it says God would give unto Christ the throne of his father David, and he would rule over the house of Israel forever. So Christ was to sit on that throne eventually, but once that scepter had been established in the people of Judah, and once that scepter had been put in the hand of David, the first Jew to hold it, God anointed him. This was God's throne. Once that happened, God said the scepter would never depart from Judah until Christ would return, until Shiloh would come. And Christ has not come. It doesn't mean his first coming. It refers to his second coming, obviously, when the real gathering of the people will be. And so, anyway, we're going to see then how some of these things occur. Now let's look, before we go into some of the historical sections, I want you to notice here another very interesting bit of information in Genesis chapter 38. And I'm just going to read the last part, read the whole chapter sometime. Here it talks about Judah. Judah was the ancestor of all the Jews. That is, those who were ethnically Jews, or racially speaking, or Jews. Now, here was a woman by the name of Tamar. She was pregnant by Judah. She had twins. Notice in verse 27, it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. Came to pass when she travailed that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, or a scarlet cord or thread, saying, this came out first. And it came to pass, this little twin, this little boy, drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out, that is, ahead of him. And she said, the midwife said, how have you broken forth, you little rascal? Now, you know, you've kind of mess things up here. This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Pharaoh, which means a breach. And afterward came out his brother that had his scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zara. Now, Judah was his father, and Pharaoh and Zara were his descendants. And they became the two most illustrious ancestors of Judah's son. Now, if you'll read earlier in this chapter, Judah married a Canaanite woman, and God said the Canaanites were under a curse, and the Messiah could not come of that line. His name is Keilah, but I don't want to go into that. None of the Bible or the great men came from Keilah. The real leaders came from either Pharaoh or Zara. Now, Pharaoh was the firstborn, so his descendants eventually would be the ones who would have the scepter and would produce the Messiah. And so David, if you'll check all the genealogies, his genealogy, his ancestry goes back to Pharaoh, not to Zara. But if you'll check the commentaries and you'll check the scriptures,
you'll find that Zarah had, he had four or five sons, and Pharaoh's had, I think, was it one or two? Anyway, the sons of Zarah were much more numerous than the sons of Pharaoh. Now, why do I mention that? And why does God tell here such an unimportant thing as this little lad had a red or scarlet cord on his hand? Why does God mention that unless it has some significance? And I'm going to tell you tonight what that significance is. Now, if you want to know, here's a book to Ulster's credit. It shows how that some of the people who came into Ulster have this symbol of the red hand. That's like a scarlet thread, a red cord tied around the hand. And I want to show you tonight how these people got this symbol. It goes back to the tradition that the red cord around the hand tied around their ancestor, who was not to be the ancestor of Christ, but nonetheless was a Jew, and he was going to establish a royal throne, so far as I'm concerned, not the one that the Messiah would rule, but nonetheless, he would certainly establish, as we know from history he did, many of the royal families of Europe. In fact, I think you'll find all of them today take themselves back to Zara, to that one. I want to show you here in my own words now a little bit about this mess. I hope you can see this back there, but it's a little far for some of you. But this is the Mediterranean Sea down here. Here's Egypt. The Israelites came out of Egypt. They inhabited the Promised Land about 1446, let's say the middle of the 15th century. At about 930 B.C., the kingdom became divided between the northern part called Israel and the southern part Judah. They continued to fight and war among themselves, and eventually the house of Israel were taken into captivity according to 1 Kings chapter 17. Read it, about the first third. I've got the scriptures, but you can look it up. Just save time. That happened. Some of them were taken in captivity at 734, or very near that place. The final captivity, when the remainder of Israel were conquered, the capital city of Samaria was defeated, was in 721 B.C. Now, that's the 8th century B.C. The Bible says these people, the Israelites, were taken, you can read the scriptures, it says they were taken into the land of Assyria, and it says they were taken, some of them were taken into the cities of the Medes. That's right here, south of the Caspian Sea. This is the Caspian Sea. Can you read it there? Caspian Sea, Black Sea. And it says some of them were put, if you'll read there, it mentions the word Habor and the Hala. Well, I don't want to go into the Hala part, but the Habor, according to various sources I could read here, it shows it's sometimes called the Abor, sometimes the Aborus, and so forth. The modern name is Araxes, the river right here. And I've got another map here that I think I can pull out and show you that it will perhaps make that even plainer. If you can see this map here, well, a little difficult. But right here between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea is a place called Armenia. See up there? Now, Armenia was a different size. Sometimes it was larger, sometimes smaller. Here it shows it going all the way from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea. Now, in that area of what is there shown as Armenia, in that area of Armenia, these people were taken up here into the area of the Habura, the Kabura, of the Habur River, and to that area. Now, I've got the quotes here in different books to show you that, but you can look it up. So remember this, the Israelites were taken up here, some even put in the area of what modern Armenia. Armenia is fighting with Azerbaijan now. Keep this in mind, because I've got several books here, and the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, maybe I could just, let me see, read this, but I've perhaps better, I'll just wait and perhaps read it later. But what it says, that the earliest inhabitants of Britain, it mentions who they were,
the ancient British of Welsh. It mentions the Scots. It mentions the English, the Scots, the Angles, and so forth. And it says that these people came, and it clearly says this. Remember, King Alfred the Great began apparently having this written in the 800s A.D. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle goes back to the 800s A.D. The very first paragraph says, and they came, you know where it says they came from? Armenia. Right here. Now I've got another ancient history, and some, if I have time, but I mustn't digress too much on that. It says that they came from northern, from this area, northern Persia, or this area of Media. Karen Turner's works I have here, I could show you this ancient history, nearly 200 years old, by Karen Turner. He's a man, actually. It sounds like a woman. The best work on the Anglo-Saxons. He says, and all of the ancient maps, I've got many very old maps, some of them 300-400 years old, they show the Sati back here. The Sati. They come up here, and over a period of many years, many centuries later, you find them coming into Europe. But what the history shows is that some early people came through here, the ancient Cimbri people. And they came around here, they named the Cimmerian Chersonesus, or the Crimea, which is named after them. And then, according to an old map that I have here, see if I can find it, I've got so many. This is an old map from a book, British, this is The Antiquities of Ancient Britain, printed in London by T. Roy Croft in 1676, over three centuries ago. Here on this map, it shows north of the Black Sea, it even has some little tents, erected here, where these ancient Cimmerian people dwelt. Now, they had come from Palestine, but I can't give you all that this evening. They'd come up through the Caucasus Mountains, they'd come and dwelt around here, and eventually, according as this map shows, these ancient people dwelt, came and lived and dwelt through here a time, and come on up into Denmark, and you find them coming on over into this area of Holland, Denmark, and from there, you find many of them going over here. Now, Wales today is called Cymru, C-Y-M-R-U, or C-I-M-B-R-I, the Cymbri people. The North Sea, this area is called on this map, the Mare Cymbri, or the Lake of the Cymbri, or the Ocean of the Cymbri. These were the ancient names of the Welsh people, who are Wales and Western Britain, and they were driven back later, many centuries later, when the Angles and Saxons and Jutes and Normans and Danes came in here after the Romans left. That was after 410 A.D. But these ancient Celts, these ancient people over here, the Tuatha De Danann, the Scotia, Scots, the Caledonians, these people were there hundreds of years before the time of Christ, and so these people came over there. I'll show you a little bit of that. And later on, your Angles and Saxons and Jutes and Normans and Danes, those people come in later on, and they come behind the ancient Celts or Gauls, and then they come in the same territory. And as Churchill says in Volume 1 in his preface, he says all the people, whether they would be the ancient Cymbri people or the Celts, same thing, or the later the Angles and Saxons and Jutes and Danes even settled here, and then Normans with William the Conqueror in 1066, he said all these people related. And the same thing with Ireland. I've got the book here. They say that the ancient Tuatha De Danann, who were the first people to come and establish permanent colonies here that remained, after them came in a people called the Scots, or the Scotus, which I'll refer to a little later and show you where they were and how they tie in with Zara Judah. So these, and then let me point out something else. The Roman historians, of which I've got them, you can check this in the encyclopedia, show that the ancient people who inhabited Gaul were called Gauls by the Romans. The Greeks down here called the same people Celts or Celts. Same people. These were all Celts. In fact, these three people here were called Caledonians or the Gaels, but over here they were called Gauls, but they were the same people. And a book I have here I picked up in the library down in Melbourne the other day says these people came from Gaul, and they were called Gaels, and the Caledonian Gaels. There's this book called them here, this book on ancient Scottish history. That's some of the people here, but others came in of the people that were later called Scots. The Scots, they came in a little different way, and I'll show you that. later. Now, this map shows these people marching across here, covered wagons, a highway, if you can see it there, from the Black Sea up to this area, shows a highway and shows these people marching, some on horses, some on covered wagons, some on foot, coming up here, and that is what the ancient history book says. Scottish, Irish, English, they said our people came from Armenia, several of them, another book I could quote here, as well as the Anglo-Saxons, they say they came from northern Persia, here was Persia down here, up here was northern, what later became Persia, in the area of the cities of the Medes. That's where the Bible says they went, and we find some of them coming around here, taking a little longer, and they're the ones who came in through this area called Scythia, and they were known as Scythians, and they were the ancestors of all the people, most of the people, the tribes who came into Britain were called Scythians, and the Franks, and other peoples there in that part of the world. But it's, oh yes, and just one other little interesting thing. Notice it says Gauls here, it also says or Galatians. Some of these same people, the same tribes with the same names, came over here to Central Asia Minor. And what do you think they were called there? The Galatians. Now, the land of Israel, you find Galilee and Gaulonitis, and they had dwelt, the Reubenites, near the sea, you know, near the Salt Sea, and so some of these Reubenites, when they came into France, were called those who had dwelt near the Asphaltus Sea, or which is one of the names for the Dead Sea, and also called, they dwelt near Moro Musa, I believe it, anyway, it means the Dead Sea. That's what some of the ancient Gaulish people said they came from. But I don't want to digress too much into that, because I'm going to show you how these people of Zara, how they figure prominently, and of Judah, and how they chime with the royal family. And so let's go a little further here. Next, let's turn over to the Book of Kings. Let me see. Got so many scriptures here, and I'm trying to cover this rather quickly. This is really at least six or a dozen lectures that I'm condensing, trying to give you a few of the highlights here. In, I believe it's 1 Kings 4, but let me just check it here. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 31, I think is the next scripture I want. 1 Kings 4, 31. I want you to notice here, now, it's talking about Solomon's wisdom in verse 30. He was wiser. Solomon was David's son. He was a Jew sitting on the throne after David died. He was wiser than all the men, than all men, and it mentions some of the wisest men that the Bible mentions after Solomon. Notice their names: Ethan, the Ezraite, and Darda, and Mahol, and it mentions Heman and Calcolair. These were the sons of Zara. You go back, check 1 Chronicles 2, verse 6, and very clear, these were the sons of Zara. Zara had quite a number of sons, but notice one of them is called Darda, D-A-R-D-A. Now make a big note of that, because if you want to study this, what you will find is, sometime, and apparently in that 215-year period, several hundred years when the Israelites dwelt in Egypt, according to the Scottish, ancient Scottish records, some of these people came up here, and apparently it was before the Exodus, because we find them coming back in there even before the Exodus occurred. They came up here, and over here, where you go into the Black Sea, near Gallipoli, remember where the Anzac fought in World War II, I don't want to get anything painful there. But there, these people of Darda established, he was a grandson of Judah, Zara's son. It was Judah whose son was Zara, one of his sons, and Zara, he was the father of Darda. Now you can look it up in the commentary or in your concordance when you get home if you don't understand that. They came up, and according to many, many historical books, they established themselves here in a place called Troy. And some records say they built the city. Now, whether it's been destroyed and rebuilt, I don't know. Some maps I have show this area, the western part of the tip of Asiatic Turkey today. You know what that land is called on these ancient maps? It's called Dardania. D-A-R-D-A-N-I-A. Now, do you know what this waterway is called if you go right into the Black Sea? The first one, as the ships go through there? The Dardanelles. D-A-R-D-A. Dardanelles. Sardinia, Dardanelles. Eventually, Troy was destroyed, and these Jews who had established themselves there, and some Danites who'd come down to southern Greece, notice there's lots of Danites. This is just in these old Irish histories, I've got them, and some of them hundreds of years old. That's just as plainly stated as the nose on my face. Some were here, and then they went from here up in Denmark, Dansmark, or Dansland, it literally means. And then all the ancient history, so you find them coming over here in Hibernia, or Ireland, or Erne, and establishing themselves. This is before the Scots came in. I'll come back to them later, because the Scots are the different people than the Tuatha De Danann. The Tuatha De Danann are none other but the tribe or people of Dan. Now, these people of Troy established themselves there eventually, that is, the Jews of the tribe of Darda, a clan of them went up there. They established themselves there eventually. Troy was destroyed, and you can check ancient English history books. They say the ancient kings of the Britons, Brutus, I believe, is the name I recall, was a Trojan. He came from that royal family. And all of these kings, so far as I've been able to find Scandinavian kings in this area, all of them trace themselves back to these ancient sons of Darda, to the Trojan royal family. Now, it's rather interesting, when you come to this, you'll find that in Ireland today, in Northern Ireland, in this little area called Ulster, when these people who traced themselves back there to this area of the Black Sea, and who came out this way rather than like the Danites did, mainly overland, these people clearly have and brought in with them the thing I showed you earlier. We've got a copy here in this book, but the red hand of Ulster. It's called the red hand. Oh, look, here's a picture of it again. And I've got some maps. In fact, I couldn't bring them. I brought a few of my many maps. And on these ancient clan maps of Ireland, you'll find in the north, in the area of Ulster, there's a reason why there's a struggle between Ulster and the South Ireland, which is basically, there's been some intermixing, but basically the people of Dan, the Tuatha De Danann, settled it. But the people of Ulster, they trace themselves back, and you'll find many of their clans that have the red hand on it. And you'll find that that the flag of Northern Ireland, I have it here, a picture of it. You know what it's got on it? Here it is. A red lion, a scutum, the red hand, going back to the red cord tied around the hand of Zara. And you'll find, as I said, many of your clans here, when you go over to Scotland, those tribes, especially that came in from Ireland in the western part of Argyll and that western part of the Highlands, those were these same Ulster Scots, and they, you'll find again the red hand there too. Going back to the tribe of Zara Judah and to his son Darda. Now I want to read from a few secular sources, just show you I'm not talking through my hat. I know what I'm talking about. Here's an article, U.S. News World Report, March 30th, 1987. This is from one of our chief magazines in America. On the picture, it shows Cardinal O'Connor, the Cardinal of New York, greeting the mayor of New York. At that time, his name was Ed Cox. He, just a year or two ago, he lost his seat to the present mayor. I'm going to read part of it. It talks about the Irish dyed the river green in Chicago on St. Patrick's Day, and it says in New York, you know, what they were doing. And it says there were 125 marchers. For one day, everyone was Irish. Cardinal John O'Connor. Now, O'Connor is a Southern Irish name. O'Flaherty, O'Malley, Flanagan, Fitzpatrick, those are Danite names in the main over here on the coast. But your Max, most of them, not all, but most of your Max and your Grahams and your Nixons and your, well, what are Frasers, those are Ulster Scots. Or at least many of them are Scottish, or in many cases Ulster Scots, not all of them. But notice what it says. That for one day, everyone was Irish. Cardinal John O'Connor had a warm embrace for Mayor Edcott, who explained his presence at the head of the Grand Parade thusly. Here's the way he described why he was there. It's part of my roots. The the 10 lost tribes of Israel, we believe, ended up in Ireland, end quote. Quoting Mir Yitzchak. Now, why does he believe that? An educated Jew, in an Yitzchak, why does he believe that? Well, there's just a lot of reasons to believe it. Here, Danites. The Danans and the Danites. Were the Hebrews Greek? Charles Gordon, the brilliant scholar, says that a significant part of his professional life searching for connections between the early Greek, that is called Greek, and the Hebrews. And he goes on down here and showing others, and it shows definite connections between the Danite tribe and between the people who settled over here. Let me get my bearings again. I can hardly see that at the time. Right here in the southern part of Greece. I'm not going to have the time, I guess, to read this tonight, but let me tell you this. And you go to the library and you'll get a book by Josephus. Are you there in the Apocryphal writings? And what you'll read there, you'll read, it says, these Danites, or these people in the southern part of Greece, wrote a letter to Onias the high priest, their king Arius, wrote a letter, and this was, I think 200-something B.C. or 300, whenever it was, anyway, after the time of Alexander. They wrote a letter, and they said, we're your brethren. We're your kinsmen of the seed of Abraham. And they said, furthermore, to prove that, our seal is the eagle with the serpent in its claw. Now, in Genesis 49, it says, Dan will be a serpent, by the way. And the Jewish encyclopedia again shows that the serpent was at least figured in their emblem. Now, and this, they wrote the Jewish high priest, and then in Josephus and in the Apocryphal writings both, they mention the Jewish high priest wrote back and they said, yes, we know that from our records, and we understand they were not, in other words, descendants of Javan. Many of the Greeks were mostly from Javan. I don't want to go into that. But here were these Danites down here, and we know that, and we remember you in our prayers on holy days and so forth. Now that's just what the record says. Now, here's an ancient history of Ireland that I've got. I believe it's nearly 200 years old, more history of Ireland. I've got others and quotes all over the place I can show you. But just let me come to it and show you a few of the remarkable things of what it says here. It talks about the early people who came in there. Some of the earliest people were called Tuatha De Danann. And you look up, I got a big set of encyclopedias that long, and, you know, it shows that the word Tuatha, or you can look it up, it means tribe. Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Dan. Here it says that the Irish came from, quote, from the Caspian Sea. The Irish came from the Caspian Sea. Sure, they were taken part of, some of them, those in the North Island, undoubtedly, were taken up with some of the others. Others of them, I can show you, according to the prophecy in Judges, it says, why did Dan remain in ships? And when the rest of the Israelites were fighting the Philistines here, remember that it invaded in the days of Deborah, he chided the Danites. He says, you Danites, you want to send your army to help us to evict these Gentiles out of our land. And you read it there in the book of Numbers. Why did Dan remain in ships? I could turn and read it. They were remaining in their ships. They were great mariners. And you find they were seamen. Some of them may have even come this way, but mainly they seem to have come up through the Black Sea and on through this way into Denmark. But anyway, it says here the Irish religious practices came from, quote, Persia. Well, why would they come from Persia? Yes, I'm going to knock that over. Thank you for coming. Baal worship in Ireland. Well, our ancestors were into that. Baal fire, Beltane, all that. Human sacrifices. Oh, yes. You can read that in the Bible. The Israelites were offering human sacrifices and going into all sorts of paganism. Here it says, to the tribes dispersed after the Trojan War, that's when these sons of Darda were kicked out. The Trojan War, it has been the pride, equally, both of the Celtic and the Teutonic nations to trace back their origin, that is, their leaders especially, going back to there. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle derives the earliest inhabitants of Britain from Armenia, and the great legislator of the Scandinavians, Odin, is said to have come from the neighborhood of the Euxine Sea. This is an older name for the Black Sea, the Euxine Sea, because some of these people came up through here, and then Odin and his followers came on up into Scandinavia. By those who hold that the Celts and Persians were originally the same people. Well, they weren't. But the Bible says that some of these Israelites went up into the cities of the Medes in 1517. And that later became known as the Persian Empire, shortly after that. And when the Assyrians were destroyed, if Israel went here in 721 in this area, 109 years later, in 612, the capital of Assyria was destroyed in 612 B.C., and that began freeing these tribes. Some began migrating the ancient Celtic or Cimbric peoples up through here rather quickly, but later, some of the others who were later called Scythians and Sati and so forth, they come across this way hundreds of years later, and they don't arrive in Europe mainly until after the time of Christ, whereas these other tribes come over here many centuries, in the 500-600s. Some of them were arriving there in northwest Britain, not just Britain, but in northwest Europe. Here, some of the, it says that the Danites were also Scythians, that is, some of them had come out of Scythia. But here it talks about the Danans, as they call them, or the Swarthy Danans, that were in Greece. They were in Denmark and Norway and Scotland. It mentions all those countries. It says the Tuatha De Danann, a people famed for necromancy, that is, they were into all sorts of, you know, their sorcery, and they still believe in the wee folk and all this sort of business, who after sojourning for some time in Greece, where they had learned this mysterious art, proceeded from thence to Denmark and Norway, and became possessors while in those countries of certain marvelous treasures. It mentions among whom were the Stone of Destiny. Armed with these wonderful gifts and so forth, it says the tribe of the Danans next found their way to Scotland, and then finally it says they come over into Ireland. Now, without going into all of these things, let me read you here from a book. I have at home, I couldn't bring it because I can only bring so many. It talks about the official, the Westminster Abbey official guide, 1971 edition. I got it when I was in the Westminster Abbey, probably in about 1971 or 2. Talking about this coronation chair that I showed you here. It says this chair was made for Edward I, and I think you know he went to Scotland and brought the Stone of Stone down in 1296. All the histories say that. But notice, I'm quoting. It says the Scots made repeated and vain efforts to induce Edward, that is King Edward I, to give it back. That is the Stone of Stone. This tradition identifies this stone with the one upon which Joseph rested his head at Bethel. And it quotes now Genesis chapter 28, verse 18. Jacob rose up, that is after sleeping and having this dream. Early in the morning, he took the stone and he had put for his pillow. He set it up for a pillow, and he poured oil upon it, the top of it. And if you read, he says, let this stone be God's house. And today it represents the house God told David he would build. He said, I will build you in a house. And he was talking there, David already had his royal residence built. He didn't mean a physical home. He means like the house of Tudor, the house of Windsor. And he was building him a royal house. And anyway, it goes on down to show that Jacob's stone, let's see, Jacob's son carried it, that is, his stone to Egypt, and from thence it passed, eventually it says, to Spain, the King Gabalus, son of Sukkot, the builder of Athens. And then he says, about 700 B.C. Now, the dates, I don't think we know exactly when, but and some of this may not be, we may not be able to tie it down exactly, but he says, at about 700 B.C., it appears in Ireland, where it was carried by the Spanish king's son, Simon Brett. They call it Leofale, the Leofale son, and all of that. Well, that's not all. Let's go on here. I want to show you now what happened. Let's see. Come a little bit here and stay a little time. Here's a book, An Ancient History of Scotland. I want to read just a little bit of it. according to historical tradition, this is an old figure, you can hardly read it, but I'm translating the letters, it's like F, F is like F, etc. According to historical tradition, the Scots are originally descended from Greeks. Greeks means, they call them Greeks, it's like the Vanites were there, and they call them Greeks. But they were Vanites living there, just like in America, a black man is no different than the American Zion. And if you've got people from other countries, they're New Zealand, I'm in Australia. They're Aussies. But, you know, that doesn't mean nothing. Joseph is called an Egyptian in the Bible. You know, the Canaanites, when he came up, called an Egyptian. But he wasn't an Egyptian. But they call these Greeks. These were some of the sons of, I believe, not only Judah, but Gaza, who dwelt right there, let me find his name, see where it was, right here in the old cells, right across there in Greece, in that area. Clearly, Israelites were dwelling there. This is, I think, even before the Exodus, when they first went there, some of them. Anyway, it says, the Scots originally, that is, this group who came in there, were from, we know Darda, as I said, and Joseph Kerry, and they were originally, it says, a Greek, that is, they came in that area, and Greece controlled that area, you'll find later, east of there, and what's called the Dardanelles, that was even called part of Greece at one time, and I can show you that on map. The Scots originally descended from Greeks and Egyptians. I've got another book here, by the way, that says the Banner, the Tuatha de Danann, and none other than the Tuatha de Danann. It's a secular book called Celto, what is it? But anyway, there's just many, and I can't give you all that. Oh, yes. H-E-L-L-E-N, Hellosemitic, or Hellenosemitic. The word Hellosemitic is a word for the Greek. And here the people of Hellas, the Greeks, were Semites. Now yet, the Jews know that the Greek property, the proper Greek, is descended from Jordan. That's well known. And many of those same people settled in Italy, South Italy, and Sicily, and Marseille, and other places around the Mediterranean. These were not Greeks racially. They settled in Greece and were called Greeks, but they were Israelites. Now listen, that'll start. These people, the Scots, as we call them, they are the Irish Scots. They were Greek, descended from Greeks and Egyptians. As Hector, Burbus, and several other ancient writers remember. That a Greek prince, that is, he was in Greece, and part of it, named Zacchaeus, son of Cyclops, king of Athens, and he insulted the inhabitants of Macedonia and so on, was driven out. But being more inclined for warlike adventures than submit to paternal correction, he gathered a party of resolute young men and went with them into Egypt to fight against the Ethiopians, who had invaded and wasted that realm from Memphis to two cities. It says Pharaoh Orchis, that is Orchis, was named given here, in the 33rd year of his reign, gave the command of his army to Moses, the captain or leader of the Hebrews, with whom this so-called group called Zacchaeus joined his party, fought a dangerous battle wherein they overcame and pursued the Egyptians south down to a place called Saba, the chief city in the Isle of, that's up in the Nile there, that's the general area, which they took with force and subdued to King Pharaoh. That is, they were like Moses and the enemy. Joseph has mentioned this before Moses' conversion, apparently served in Pharaoh's army. Zacchaeus, having this so-called, Scotsman, having signalized his conduct and valor in this victory, was so well esteemed by the Egyptians that he obtained King Pharaoh's daughter named Clotho, and married, had large possessions given him in that kingdom where, this was written, by the way, in the same time as King James the First, in the early part of the 1500s. That's how old this book is. Anyway, had a wife named Clotho and married, and had large possessions given him in that kingdom where he and his wife, the Greek soldiers, they called them Greeks in the world, they were Israelites, who'd come with them at the same, in this case, I'm sure after some of those people of Troy had been doing it, but anyway, let's go on. He lived in two centers in Egypt for many years. But it is said that after this victory, Moses was envied and hated by the Egyptians, and as the Hebrews grew numerous and formidable, the Egyptians were jealous of them, fearing they would reverse the government of the kingdom, oppressed them with grievous taxes and servitude, and Moses had revenge the Israelites, the injuries done to his people on an Egyptian when he then gave his life when he fled into the land of Midian, where he received remained until he was called by divine permission to deliver the Israelites from Egyptian bondage and conduct them to the land of promise. This man is the ancestor of the Scots, and listen to one of them and what he said. Lazarus and his people were well respected by the Egyptians during the lifetime of the Pharaoh. Anyway, let me just tell you my own feeling what it was on the first. And I'll represent the paper. He says, after these Israelites left, he says, in other words, they were related to them. They were related to these Israelites, but after the Israelites left, some of these people who had been up in here, these early Israelites who went down there long before the directors, he says, they got in the ship and they came over through the pillars of Hercules, that's Gibraltar, and they met on the west side of the Iberian Peninsula, what is called Hispania. You'll find many maps over the Celtiberian here, these ancient Celts. The Celts and the Gauls, they say, remember that, they were the Greeks called themselves, the Romans called themselves, they were all the same people. They had the deity for the religion of the Druids. They spoke the Celtic language, the Gaelic language, or the Gaelic language. They had the same customs and legal customs and those guys and all of that. These people were all closely connected. When Caesar invaded Gaul here, these people came to their aid. So Caesar came over here to punish them, and he said, "This is many, many, or whatever it was, I came myself, I can't remember that." And eventually, in 44 BC, under Claudius, he actually invaded this land and came up here and tried to conquer Scotland, the Caledonians. He conquered all of this area. He never, and I've got the book that shows how I went back and forth in one battle, the Scots flew 60,000 of the Roman soldiers. And finally, the Romans came back and built two walls to keep these devils out of Dublin, where they called them. The Germans called them the Ladies of Hell. Well, when they got their bagpipes and their broadswords coming up, and even the bombs came in, the Roman troops could not withstand Caledonian, or what it later was called, Scottish arms here. They were driven back and time again, or they went up several times and finally gave it up and built the two walls, the Antonius Wall and Hadrian's Wall, and keep up the Stephen's North. But anyway, so what this man said, they came over here and they jumped in a place called Portugal. So they gave him the dollars and they called it Portugal because the prince called Portugal. And eventually he says they had many battles. With these ancient peoples are the same, as we know them today. We had many battles, and they said that eventually they came up here looking for land, and eventually they settled, and Moses of Ireland, this 200-year-old book, and I was after this, after Ireland, came the Philippid Islands, which all these books show, all of them, then came in this people called Scotland. And as these books show, pretty soon, this family, they were a family, a group, and they always, wherever they went, wherever they came, very quickly subdued the Philippid Islands and started ruling the thing. You know what they called it? Scotia. That's where it came from. Until 1100. Until about 1100 AD, this was called Scotia. Some of these people from this island, especially the strongholds in North Ireland, the Ulster side, and then some here in the year established in the western part of Scotland, in Argyll, that area, they were known as the Scots. And they then subdued the Scots from the century, where the Scots of Ireland, actually, it was a peaceful agreement, and the common deal to these Scottish people, and to their rule, and that's That element were primarily of Zara Judah. And then here's another pose. Talked about the cooks and the Caledonians. I'll pass over that.
I have mentioned that Zara had a scarlet thread tied around his hand. I want to also mention now, and you think I could take another 20 minutes? Is that too much? A little too much. Maybe not quite that long. Okay, all right. Well, I know we have to get out here. But anyway, let me just say, if you will go back, and I'll just suggest you read this, I'll whip through this. Jeremiah 1:10, God says, Jeremiah was appointed to pull down and destroy the nation of Judah and the kingdom of Judah. Jeremiah warned the kings, they didn't repent, and so God said that no king of this line would ever prosper again, ruling anymore in Judah. You can read that in the 22nd chapter. In Jeremiah 39, verses 6 and 7, you'll find that there it says that the last king that ruled in Judah was King Zedekiah, and it says he was slain. It says all his sons were slain, and it says the nobles were slain. It says the nobles were slain. In other words, all the royal-blooded people were slain. This only left the king's daughters, and that's why in Jeremiah 43, you read this later if you want to, verses 6 and 7, it says, Jeremiah went down to the land of Egypt, and it was taken there with the king's daughters and his scribe or secretary, Jeremiah's secretary Baruch, and it says that they came to a place called Tahpanhes, and today the Arabs still call that the fortress of the Jews' daughters, Tahpanhes, right here in northeastern Spain. And these people, according to ancient Irish history, show that an Eastern Oriental princess came over, intermarried, and an aged sage or wise man who established a college over here in Ireland, and undoubtedly they came over. I suspect that may be when the stone of scone was brought, but maybe not. That God may have had that bet to Ireland some other way. But one thing they undoubtedly brought over, the main thing, was the royal blood. Because God had said in Psalm 89 and other places that David would always have a son or a descendant on his throne. That's mentioned in several places in the Bible. I don't want to go into that now. David would always have a descendant on his throne. In Ezekiel 17, the last chapter, chapter 17, the last few verses, you put it down and read it later, It talks about God was going to take the throne, the highest branch, and it talks about a tender one, a daughter of Zedekiah, and plant it in the height of a nation of Israel. And the Israelites, many of them, had already filtered into Northwest Europe, into this area, over a period of many hundreds of years. Remember, this was in 586 when Judah fell. And many of the Israelites came over here even before Israel fell in 721. So Jeremiah and these daughters, the royal daughters, came over here. Now, I've got a book here, an ancient Scottish history of Caledonia, and several places in here it talks about Jacob's pillar stone, it talks about the Sabbath, it talks about these people who came in here building altars and 12 stones for the 12 tribes of Israel, these Scottish people, and it talks about they came to, these ships were coming either to Gaul, or it mentions to, I'm sorry, what was the word there? Britain, I guess it was, the island, Britain, or the island called Jeremiah. Or Jeremy's land, not the island, but it calls this island was called Jeremiah's land. And it's so mentioned three times in this book, the land of Jeremiah. When I was in Northern Ireland, I said, where's Jeremiah married? The first, buried. The first man I talked to said, out here in Loch Earn. Now, whether he's buried there or some think it's another place, the fact is, the Bible doesn't mention Jeremiah after about 586. There's nothing in secular history except this place, this little island up here, says that Jeremiah came there and was buried. This is a tradition that they still have, and no other nation on earth claims that, so far as I know. The Jews don't say he went to Babylon. They have no proof he went to Alexander, Egypt, or any place. He went to Ireland. Now, there's another thing, and that is, on the British royal throne, on the British royal seal here, what is that thing? If you will look at it, and it's here buried under some of these things, you'll find that it has a harp on the royal coat of arms, a harp. And that harp, I'll just mention that briefly, I think is just one of several more signs. That harp goes back to the fact that David was a harpist. And David played on that harp. And I think the royal daughters must have brought this in. I want to read you from the father of Galileo, the famous Galileo, what his father said. Talking about the harp, he says, this most ancient instrument was brought to us, Italians, from Ireland, where such are most excellently worked and in great number, the inhabitants of said Ireland have made this their art during their many centuries. They paint and engrave it, the harp, in their public and private buildings and on their hills, stating as their reason for so doing that they, that some of these people in Ireland, doesn't mean all of them, but the royal people who came in there and were the leaders among the Ulster Scottish people, they have descended from the royal prophet David. Now, David, it says, took a harp and played before Saul. Read that in 1 Samuel chapter 16. Said he could play well on a harp when Saul was sick. You also read that it says David was a prophet. You read that in Acts 2:29, especially verse 30. The royal prophet David, he was the ancestor of Tiatephi or whatever her name was, this princess whom Jeremiah brought in here and undoubtedly brought the harp and some other treasures from the wreck of Jerusalem because God said David would always have a man sitting on his throne. Now from Ireland, these people who named this, then it was formerly called a different name, Hibernia, it was called Scotia. They went over here and gained control of this part of the land, and then it became the land of the Scots, Scotia's land. And then they went to Canada, later some of them, and they were called, and they called the land there Nova Scotia, New Scotland. Again, they were a small people, and certainly were not that numerous ever. Even in Ireland, they were never a numerous people, and even in Scotland when they went over here, the majority of the Caledonian Picts or the Caledonian Gaels were not of this Scottish clan, and as this book that I have here says, the name Scott passed to them, but before that they were known as Alban or Caledonia. But they took the name Scott. I want to read you what from a, something that a man handed me the other day, and it's and I'll close pretty quickly, hopefully. To Ulster's credit, Ulster is the six counties where these ancient sons of Zara, of the Red Branch, the right red hand, came. And then later, some of the Zara line of Zedekiah's daughters came in and intermarried, so now the queen, and I've got charts, I didn't bring them here, but you can get them that go all the way back to David, and I've got a chart here that shows going back through the Scottish and Irish kings and back, you know, from Troy and from Zara and Darda, from there right on over until Zedekiah comes over, that is, his daughters come over and join. But I want to read, here it talks in this land how the, some of these same Scots, again, small in numbers, and by no means a major part of the people who went to America, and they came in a later time, and they needed frontiersmen, they needed fighters, they needed people to defend those colonies against the Indians. And they went in there, and they didn't wait for word from Washington. They had a gun in one hand, and the Presbyterian Scots had a Bible in the other hand. And when the Indians raped or scalped somebody, they went out and gave them swift justice. Now, King James VI, who himself was Scotland, when he came to England, he immediately sent over the Ulster plantations and a bunch of others back here because this was still Catholic at the time. He was trying to get this, make sure this was controlled, and then he sent a bunch of, well, later on, mostly the Scots went to America, but the first colony, Jamestown, was founded by, under King James I's reign. But this book brings out, and I've checked in about, I think, 15 of the first 30 U.S. presidents were Ulster Scots. Most of our major generals in the Civil War, in World War I and II, had Scottish names. Patton is a Scottish name, and you don't have to have a MacArthur. And they either go back to Northern Ireland, Ulster Scotland, Ulster Scots, or to Ireland. And again, Judah was a warring tribe. They were the tribe that God put there to, at first to go out as a spear point. Here's a quote from General David Fraser's book. We have a man here by the name of Scott. Quote, without the Irish regiments, that's the Ulster Scott, it means not Southern Irish, because I think we know they haven't been too keen. They were. Some say they had Nazi submarines there in World War II, but anyway, they, as we know, have had some problems with the royal family. Without the Irish regiments, that is from Northern Ireland, the story of the British Army would be impoverished. It would be the poorer still without those officers of the Anglo-Irish ascendancy and of the Ulster plantations who have provided the army with many of its most illustrious names. Wellington, grandfather or great-grandparent of Churchill. Gough, Montgomery, Alexander, this is World War II, Cavan, Dill, Gort, O'Connor, Templar, Auchinleck, Allenbrook, Kitchener. They had come to Ireland with swords in their hands, unashamedly to defend the authority of the British Crown. And it goes on down here to mention some other things, that they lived with a challenge, such an atmosphere that there breeds fighting men. And so I'm not saying we should fight, that's not it. But I'm just saying that these people were a different people from most of the people of Ireland, and even from the bulk of Scotland. And they have all of the earmarks, according to the Bible, of being descendants of Judah, a small number. And I think that may describe why some of them are into finance as well as military and some of the other aspects of that. Before closing, I want to turn and read a couple scriptures. And I haven't been able to read those promises. I suggest you look them up, where God said David's throne would continue forever. But let's turn over to a couple scriptures. I'll read them very quickly so we can get out of here before too long. Luke chapter 1. We start a bit late, by the way. Mr. Dean didn't get this thing going, this show on the road. No, I held it up. I was getting my maps and things up. Anyway, this is talking about Christ, when he was born, he shall be great and shall be called the Son of the Highest. And the Lord God shall give unto him the throne of his father David. Christ, when he comes back, will be the ultimate Jew, descendant of Judah, descendant of David, of the Pharaoh's line, to sit on that throne. Now, you read Christ's genealogy in Luke 3, and there it goes right back from Mary all the way back, not to Solomon. You'll notice Solomon is not in there. Solomon's older brother, Nathan, is in Mary's genealogy, whereas Matthew chapter 1 goes back. It's Joseph's genealogy going back to Solomon, and the Bible shows God, Solomon brought a curse on himself, and Solomon is not the ancestor of Christ, and Christ did not descend from him, because of 1 Kings chapter 11, Solomon sinned, built a pagan altar to his wives, and worshiped pagan idols, and God said he was going to punish him severely. And eventually, the throne of David will be in the hand of Jesus Christ, who descended not from Solomon, but from Solomon's older brother, Nathan. You can look that up in the Bible. The final scripture, then, I will read. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 9. And while you're turning there, let me refer you to something. I don't have time to read this. I have here a copy of the Scottish Declaration of Independence under King Robert the Bruce in 1320. Now, this goes back about 7 centuries. And I'll just tell you what it is, if any of you want to come and read it. But I'll just tell you briefly while you're turning to Isaiah 9, verse 6 and 7. What it says is, our ancestors came into this area 1,200 years after the Exodus, after the children of Israel left Egypt in the Exodus. Now, can you imagine the Chinese or the Belgians, or at least the peoples of Africa or any other nation saying that? These people who came in, especially the Ulster Scots, who came in, they were a different group, and they definitely had the history of their taking part there and being in Egypt at the time of the Exodus, and of their being friendly with Moses and related in very different ways with Moses and the chieftains there. This is what their records say. And they even use the Exodus because these things were in their memory and in their history. Here in closing, Isaiah chapter 9, verses 6 and 7. And notice what it says about this throne of David. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government, that is, of the whole world, will be upon his shoulders. He's called the Prince of Peace. But notice verse 7. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth forevermore. Jesus Christ will take over that throne, the very same throne which the Bible says Solomon sat upon, the, quote, throne of the Lord. It was the Lord's throne that he gave to David. And then it said Solomon sat on the Lord's throne, and today Queen Elizabeth II sits on the throne of the Lord that God gave to David and said your descendants will sit on that throne, and that the scepter would remain in the hand of a Jew until Shiloh would come. And so God has kept his word, not only the prophecy in Genesis chapter 49 verse 10, but God has kept his several promises to David, which you can find especially Psalm 89, saying as long as the sun and the moon and the stars would shine, David would always have a descendant sitting on his throne. And if you look up there tonight, if it's clear, if you look up there tomorrow, you'll find the sun and the moon and the stars are still shining. Now, that is the world's oldest throne, brethren. You, I think, should be highly privileged and highly honored to realize God transferred the throne of David out of Judah. There have been no more Jews sitting on that throne ever since then. And he said he would transfer it, Ezekiel 17, into the height of the people of Israel, and it has come over into the British Isles, into Ireland, and from there to Scotland, and from Scotland to London, England. And the present royal family are descendants of that ancient throne, the world's oldest throne, the throne of the Lord, which he gave to David and Solomon and his descendants by covenant forever, that he said Jesus Christ himself will sit on when he returns to this earth. I'm sorry I kept you over too late. But Mr. Dean, he'll just have to take a half an hour off his next Bible study, and that'll make it work. Anyway, thank you very much for your patience. I know it's a bit hot in here, and I've tried to cover a lot of material,
and to probably confuse some of you, but I think you'll find there is a lot of information that is in the books that people just look there for it to corroborate what the Bible says about God's throne that he gave to David. Good night.